song tonight and her song confession. If we begin by doing just that, standing and singing together, a collect that is 170 in the hymnal, invoking the strong name of the Trinity. And Triune God, O be our stay, O let us perish never. Cleanse us from our sins, we pray, and grant us life forever. Keep us from the evil one, uphold our faith most holy, and let us trust you solely. With humble hearts and lowly, let us put God's armor on, with all true Christians running, our heavenly race and shunning, the devil's wiles and cunning. Amen, amen, this be done, so sing we alleluia. Please receive. I'd like you to hear a few words from Wilhelm Leah about our subject. The more the church learns to know itself, its foundations of holy doctrine, its position in the world and among the confessions, and its calling, and the more it uses the means at its command, the greater the blessings that will reward its faithfulness. What that church learns about the true faith is expressed not only in the sermon, but is also prayed in the prayers and sung in the hymn. In this way, the prayers and the hymns serve the church as a new defense against its enemies. It becomes a holy weapon of defense and offense in the Lord's battles. So true, so true. Well said. I think the place to begin is to define what the hymn is for Lutherans. I'd like to give you a Lutheran definition. You will not find this in any dictionary. The hymn is a song confession of the faith. That fits us. I think it's a great little definition. Now, most of Christendom is not going to be happy with this definition. They're particularly troubled with two words in there. The word confession and the word the. Why do we have to believe what we sing? You see, why are you being so serious about this stuff? Lighten up. So they would really like us to cross that out. And the problem with this word, they'd like to change the word "the" to "my." So we're left with, a hymn is singing about my faith. Well, that is very, very different, isn't it? Because when you start to go around and, you know, your experience, your understanding of your faith and yours and then yours and then, and it becomes a very individualized and an experiential type of understanding of what it is we're doing here. And then, if we don't even really have to believe it, well, it'll just be an enjoyable activity, right? Let's just leave it at that?
Well, unfortunately, this very low view of him singing is the popular view. It is what is out there. And that low view says, well, this is enjoyable, crowd-pleasing fluff, maybe, on the way to the real stuff. And the real stuff, of course, would be the sermon and the readings and the prayers. Now, Lutherans believe, I don't see this difference in any of the biblical references to singing of the church. Or if you look at the confessions, I do not see them talking about kind of a downtime where we're going to have a little fluff on the way to the real stuff. It's always talking about the real stuff, the food, the proclaiming that is going on throughout the divine service. So that's the high view, I'm afraid, and the high view is very unpopular. And it is the hard root. Because very often then we're not dealing with people's likes and dislikes the way they would like us to. Because we're not going to leave this in the realm of likes and dislikes. This is a much higher thing that we're talking about here. We are talking about what we just stood before and did. We stood and we sang a confession of what we truly believed, and that is very different from the low popular view of whatever they want. You know, let's take a survey and find out what people might like to sing. And then we'll base our church's hymnody on that survey, and then we will respond to what people say when we meet in the narthex and they tell us what they would like to sing. See, I'd like tonight to talk to you about this high view of the sung confession as a part of the proclamation and the teaching of the church. And it's going to be handled in a very, very different manner. I think this is important because we have here one of the main teachers of the church. So if we are going to see this as a sung confession, an activity that is indeed going to be teaching us, it had better be a right confession. And it is going to be carried by one of the most powerful gifts that God has given to his people and this earth, and that is the gift of music. Back in the fall, I was preparing my adult choir for an All Saints Choral Communion service. And so for about 6 weeks, we were working on some great texts leading up to that All Saints Day. And after Wednesday night rehearsals, I would come home and there would be one phrase that would stick in my my memory for the next 3 days. And I bet I sang that to myself 60 times a day, you know, for the next 3 days. And that went on for 3 or 4 weeks. This little phrase, and he shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. Now that may not be a phrase that would catch in your memory, but those words, and he shall wipe away all tears from their eyes. I was saying that to myself over and over again throughout the day, even while I may have been talking to somebody else, because that music was in the back of my mind connected with those words. Now, that's a powerful teacher. It is carrying to the memory of all ages, to the young and to the old, this confession carried by music. And we never know after Sunday's divine service what little phrase our people will take home with them. You know, it may... We do know that it is far more likely that they will take home a phrase from a hymn than from the sermon. That is true because it does have that it has been repeated throughout their life, and it has that music connected to it. They may go home with might of ours cannot be done. Now, that's a good thing to be going home saying, you know, with might of ours. How much can be done with that, you know? We never know. There's good, healthy little bits and pieces all the way through, carried by music. So here again, we better make sure that it's right, that what they're going home does indeed represent us. I'm talking about memory here, I have been over this last year and a half seeing about 50 to 70 shut-ins a month at St. Paul's. And it has been a powerful lesson for me in how important that memory is at a point in your life when your senses are starting to fail you. You know, as the hymn says, faith shall cry as fails each sense. Jesus is my confidence. That hymn says it. It says it very beautifully. I mean, I will walk into a room sometimes and this poor person will be not making any sense at all. You know, I'll walk in and she says, I work for the President of the United States. You know, and the next sentence might be, and the Secret Service told me that my husband loves me. And the next sentence does not make any sense either. And you sit down and you start to talk to this confused person. And you start to see a focusing that is going on here that leads you to the point. As I take out a linen and I set up the crucifix and I begin to talk about what we are going to be about here, and then I ask her if she would like to receive the Lord's Supper, she says, yes. I start to say the liturgy because she has focused into what is happening here. I start to say the liturgy. She says all of her parts and all of my parts. The memory has kicked in a way that is incredible. It's beautiful to behold. She sings the Creator in me a clean heart with me. And by the time we get to the Sanctus, I have a pretty big voice, but she is out singing me. And the nurses are coming to the door to see what all the ruckus is in there. I mean, and the... For her whole life, she has been rehearsing these very words and truths of her faith that are indeed just exactly what she needs at this point. And so that memory is a very important and very important aspect of the solemn confession of the church, and the fact that it is the music that carries it helps. Now, the fact that this is a confession makes our hymnody deeper and more difficult than other church bodies. In fact, I've even read some comments about Martin Franzmann's hymns in some hymnology books that say this is it's a heavy meal of dogma. You know, it's like, you know, you have to think while you are singing this kind of hymn, you know. And you're not used to that, you see, in many other churches. And so we have difficult hymns. We have difficult hymnals. As Martin Franzmann said in his beautiful little homily on Colossians 3:16, he said, "Whoever said a hymn has to be easy? If we're going to give it this high role, it is going to be something of substance. But then don't we have a lifetime to learn it? We do." You see, that is the approach I'd like pastors to take time with this important subject with your people. And it's not something they are going to get and love immediately, but they see that you love it. How much it is a part of your confession and your practice, the whole life of faith. And actually, they probably then view it in how you are with your family, too. I mean, do you sing with your family? You know, do you talk about singing in the home? Having devotions that actually sing about the truths also. So they see you. They see that this is something that means a great deal to you. You stand up there in the divine service and you sing with everything you've got, even if you can't sing. And they notice that because our eyes, whenever we look to the front of a sanctuary, are going to focus on an individual. And we're going to see if you left to go to the vestry during the singing of the hymns, you see, or if you're standing there leading us with everything that you've got. And then if you hold up hymnody in your preaching and help our people to have texts come alive because we have seen how they relate to biblical texts and to the church here. And all of that becomes richer, and then the next time when they sing that hymn, it is a much richer activity for them because you have helped to educate them through your not just liturgical preaching, but, you know, this is a preaching that brings hymnody into it. So we have a more difficult hymnal. Let's just admit it, okay? And then let's maybe decide how are we going to give this more difficult hymnody to our people. I would advise that your first week in a parish that you sit down with at least the last 3 years of bulletins, and then you feed all the numbers into your computer, and you find out what that church knows. Now, you may be depressed at the end, but you need to know where to start, because you cannot really just come in with your repertoire or what you have been exposed to at the seminary. You know, and you have come to love. You've had far more exposure than they have. And you can't just expect them to open the hymnal and all of a sudden be able to do a lot of these hymns. You know, like the hymn we sang, the 170, you may have grown up with it, but then you may be sent to a parish that has never sung it. Well, you can't just expect them to sing it the first time without help. So you need to know where I think your parish is, and And then you start to find out, well, what could we add in this first year? And what teaching resources could we actually bring into place to help this, bring the song confession to the people in a way that they're not going to feel, overly challenged. I'm actually even against the hymn of the month, because it seems like every month there is this new hymn. And by the end of the year, do you really know those 12 new hymns well? Do you treasure them? Or, are you feeling like you never really got any of them? I use the hymn of the season. I use about 5 new hymns a year, but at the end of the year, I want my parish to treasure those 5 hymns. And they can almost tell you just right off, what are those 5 hymns they've learned? They now will, I think, have them for the rest of their life. And a hymn of the season, one for Advent, one for Epiphany, one for Lent, Eastertide, and then maybe one throughout the other part of the year. You're able to, let me just tell you how I present a hymn in my parish setting, which is very different from how I presented at the seminary. Because, of course, at the seminary, you've got all the resources going for you. You can just assume more. I could just give you guys a hymn and you just read it. But that's not how it works in a parish. And a congregation learns through repetition. And they have to hear something first. There's probably a quite a small percentage of your parish that actually reads music. So they're going to be following a choir or something that they have heard a number of times with the musical part of it. So if I'm going to start a new hymn, several months before, I will be playing that hymn during distribution, during voluntaries. I will be getting the sound of that tune into the life of this parish. It starts to become a very familiar tune. Any chance I can get, and usually the distribution is a perfect time because I have a lot of distribution usually goes on for 25 minutes, and I can definitely work some time in there when I'm going to expose them to this new tune. Then the when you want to introduce it to them for the first time as a congregation, I would have the most beautiful sound in your parish present that first, to play through just the melody. See, they don't need the harmony. That's really maybe even going to confuse them. But that melody line, in our parish, we've got this 22-year-old guy who plays the oboe, and you have to listen to every note. It's so beautiful. So if he plays this line, and he finishes it, and everybody's saying, that is great, Well, they already love it, you see. And then I might have a singer sing the first verse, and just a pleasant singer, not a wobbly kind of, or somebody that's hard to listen to, but a very pleasant, clear voice singing that first verse. And then the choir sings the second verse in a strong unison, you see. And that congregation hasn't been asked to do anything yet, but they have loved everything that they've heard so far. And they also see that I have taken great pains as a pastor or as the church musician here to present this in a way that they can get it. I haven't just assumed that they can get it and that it's going to be a major struggle. I have paved the way here. And then maybe about the third or fourth verse, I bring them along with the choir still singing in unison, and maybe a trumpet along too. And it flies. But that's not enough. You've got to reinforce that. It's the repetition for as many Sundays as you can get that in afterwards without it seeming contrived. But you get that in there and then keep using it. And then you've got something new in their repertoire. You know, I could actually, even as I go along here, if you'd like me to answer any questions, I'd be happy to do that, or I could save it to the end. Are there any comments or questions as I go along? Because I'm actually just going to be talking about how we apply this practically to the parish. Are there any comments, questions? Okay. I also would recommend that you hold up this book or TLH as a prayer book where you are going to be using the strengths and avoiding the weaknesses. And not necessarily talking about the weaknesses at all, because I don't think we really need to in these times be going around bashing the prayer books. I mean, there's enough of that going on, and you just need to know what are the strengths, the weaknesses. You use the strengths, you avoid the weaknesses. I think both of the hymnals are flawed, of course, seriously. But that's why I think it's good for you to study what is the stuff to stay away from, in both of these, and then you go out there and that assembly that helps to shape your practice with those. We have schools where our children can be brought up in these prayer books. I think that with our children, we have one of the areas where we have missed opportunities of, and where our children are subjected to a double standard. It seems. Kurt Marquardt has said, you know, if we give our children Baptist ditties, then we should not be surprised when they join the Baptist church as adults, because that is where they will feel comfortable. I think this is true. And yet what do we often give our children to sing in Sunday school? And even in our parochial schools and VBS, do we give them something that does indeed represent us, that is a sung confession of Lutheranism, or does it represent somebody else? Now, these are the prime years when a child is going to learn these very things, especially if there is a teacher who truly loves this and imparts that love to these kids. And if we miss those grades 2, 3, 4, and 5, and we give them something foreign to us during those years, then we've missed it. We really have. And I find it almost impossible then in the teenage years with confirmation age, or the junior high and the senior high, if they have not had that kind of foundation, to bring them around to this at that point. They don't have anything to come home to. They haven't been given anything really to love. In fact, they've been given something that we don't even give our adults. Something very, very different. But our children can do it. I am absolutely convinced. It's amazing what they can do. I have been in homes with visited homes of pastors where every member of the family has their own little hymnal. And after dinner, you know, even the three-year-old has hers. You know, and she obviously can't, but she tries to hum along. And the five-year-old and the eight-year-old, and they're not singing little ditties either. They're singing hymns like 3:30, you know, the gospel shows, the Father's Grace and things like that. And they're doing it for maybe 2 whole weeks every day. And that child is learning that hymn in the home. You see, it just is something very natural that you do. We have in my home, we've always done that too. And we started doing it before, I can't remember at what point I got these little books, but it was before my children were teenagers. And so it became the norm in our house to always sing a hymn as a part of devotions after a meal. And then as my son was going through his teenage years and my daughter, they didn't think anything of it. We just do it. You see, there was really no rebellion at this over this quite natural thing. I mean, there was a time really when the prayer book was a very prominent thing in a home. I mean, it would be on the buffet, and it would be at the bedside, and it would be a treasured book. Or somebody could turn in times of joy and in times of sorrow or wherever, and they knew where to look in here for those prayers. I see this coming back. I really do. We have all over Fort Wayne. We've got people with kids with these little books and their names on them. And I don't know if you're seeing it that much here, but I tell you, there really is this coming home to the hymnal happening. But it takes the school, it takes the teachers singing in their classrooms. Here again, singing those hymns that you want them to sing for the rest of their life. And in the homes and in the Sunday school, yes.
Well, you mentioned the teachers. Is there staff meeting at St. Paul's where you say, hey, you know, let's work on this hymn, K through 8, for a couple of weeks? I mean, is that the type of thing you're talking about, involving the teachers and the children?
Okay, what we do at St. Paul's is the hymns that will be in the divine service are published for all of the choir directors, the pastors, field workers, the teachers. And so they will have that in advance. They will know what the hymns coming up in the next Sunday will be. Those are the hymns that we encourage them to use. Now, we also have a graded approach, because obviously not all hymns are appropriate for first and second graders, both in terms of musically and in terms of what is being said. But so we also limit it to a graded approach. But mainly it is getting ready for that divine service. But you see, it takes quite a bit more effort, doesn't it? Because you're going to have some planning about what are those hymns going to be, but that really helps the choir directors too, because then they can see how to pick their music, and fit the theme and everything. If they've got those hymns, they may have a better idea of what the day is about than even with just a statement of the theme. Yes. Okay, I get asked this question all the time, and so my wife and I actually last summer put together a graded approach, And it is available through the Divine Service Institute, too. It is, we've taken grades 1, K through 8. We've taken both hymnals, and we've gone all the way through and told which hymns are appropriate for those. Okay. The Divine, any of the lectures or anything that Bob was mentioning from the Divine Service Institute, you can get through St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Fort Wayne. Just look it up in the annual, and I can give you some more information later on what is available there. But that, I think that graded approach would help with what you're talking about. This little CD that we made too. In fact, we're talking about making a second and a third CD because they are really, CPH is selling them for us, and they're really selling very well. I think there is a need out there for hymns and liturgy sung by children, so that people see that children can indeed do it, and they can learn these hymns in an effortless way in the car, you know, and at home and whatever. And by the, you know, there are 24 hymns. And Divine Service 2, First Setting, the parts of the Ordinary are on there. And so without even having a teacher, these children have learned 24 hymns and the parts of the Ordinary in an effortless way. These are the kind of tools I think you're probably going to need. I think it's also incredibly important choosing just the right person to be the teacher of these young ones in this area. It should be the most, it should be somebody on your team so that they're teaching the same thing that you believe they should be teaching, but then musically they also have to be able to do it in a way that the kids are going to love it. Okay? It's not going over to the piano and plunking out like this. That's negative teaching. It has to be somebody who can just get down on the floor, you know, with them and sing a hymn, and then sing a phrase and have them sing along, and then and just in a good teacher, not just somebody who agrees to do it. But this is important enough that I think we need to seek out. We maybe should go and look for the people to handle the subject. We have choirs that should be helping us, I think, with all of this. So often I see choirs that don't understand their role, and they are out there doing their anthem, and my choir at St. Paul's, its main function is to lead the singing, to lead this song confession, and the liturgy and the hymns with everything they've got. Because that strong block of sound that they are sending out from their voices is a better leader than even the greatest pipe organ. You see? And even if I don't have them sing anything else, I have them sing liturgically. And I have them sing along on the liturgy and the hymns. And they love to gather in the balcony to do just that, because they know how important that is to the singing of the whole church that day. And then if they can get something ready that also is a choral response that does fit the day, wonderful. And if they can carry that on and do another thing during the distribution, that carries that theme on in an even richer way a little bit later in the service, great. But first and foremost, they are leading this sung confession. Because you see, for one thing, I'm talking about a singing church here, and we are living in a time that is contrary to singing. There used to be singing in the fields and singing in the homes and singing your child to sleep, and everybody used to be such a natural thing for people to just break out in song and gather around the piano and have sing-alongs, and that was maybe a main Friday night activity, you know. And in all of that, it, at this point, has changed. We are trying to hold up here a singing church in a time when people are reluctant to open their mouths at all. Maybe for happy birthday, you know. But even you pan at a baseball game, they pan the crowd during the national anthem or, you know, take me out to the ball game or something. And how many people are actually even in that involved in singing at that point? And then they come in the church and we're asking them to do a lot of singing. You see? So this is something that at this point in our life is quite a foreign thing from the other 167 hours of the week. But that's good. Isn't this about the other? Isn't this a different hour from everything else that we're doing all week? So in some respect, I think that's okay. That's okay to have this singing as a part of this time of the divine service. But we as pastors, I think, have to think about how we have to go out of our way, I think, to make this a natural and a good thing. And our choirs are a big help, especially then once you start to get the children involved in doing this too. I think it will help your parish to see the high view of hymnody if every time you choose a hymn they can see clearly a good reason why. It wasn't just that you chose a hymn because, well, it'd be good for us to stand up and sing a hymn at this point, you know, what would people like to sing? But if even in a voters meeting or whatever, if you're going to have a devotion, you have a hymn that fits what that week is about, and if you're going to have a reading, it would tie in with that reading and that collect, and they always see it liturgically. You see, and then on Sunday morning they see that every one of your choices is yet another reinforcement of what they heard from the lectern and the pulpit. It wasn't sending people off in different directions throughout the whole divine service with one hymn about this subject and one about this and this, and then the organist is playing something, who knows what, and then the choir is singing something because they finally got it ready, but who knows why, you know, they're singing this on this Sunday. You see, that confuses. But if we bring this all around a unified theme, and then the first hymn gives us a clear picture of what that day is going to be about, and then we work our way up to the hymn of the day, and that hymn of the day is a hymnic sermon. It is the best text you can find that is going to say what you're going to say. And then even during the distribution, we're going to continue to reinforce that. And then the hymn at the end, the hymn to depart, yet once again reinforces that same theme. They start to see that there is a good reason why you're choosing these hymns. You're not following your own personal list of favorites or your wife's. This is serious. I kid you not about this, because if they see this in the realm of favorites, then they think, he can choose because it's his favorite, you see? And that's when they start to bring in their requests. Leave it out of that realm. Get it up high into this higher realm of, this is healthy for us to be standing and singing together on this particular day in the life of the church. Be careful about this other aspect about hymnody. It's often connected with emotions. Let me just talk just a little bit about this. You know, as Lutherans, they often accuse us of either not having any emotions or denying that we have any. And I think you're probably, as future pastors, going to get asked questions about this. When I have my whole choir around me up at St. Paul's, I am really amazed at how often there are, in fact, emotions, there are tears during just any divine service. Now, why? Is it because I went after those emotions? I tried to manipulate them? No. It is because they were singing these truths of their faith and they were overwhelmed by them. And tears, and that's a natural thing to be overwhelmed by the beauty of what God has done for us in His Son. And very often those emotions will flow. I see it all the time in the Lutheran Church. Now the difference here is,
emotions do not lead faith.
Possible, as I just said, faith can indeed lead to emotions as we are standing and confessing this together. We can indeed be overwhelmed, but the emotions does not. If we start with the goal of working the emotions, of manipulating the emotions, and I think you know what I'm talking about. I mean, I could use hymnody in that way. I can get people all worked up, you know, kind of the old revival kind of thing, you know, where the song leader gets the people all to either crying or to this fevered pitch, and he's using music to do it. Of course you could use music in that way, and I could even use the Lutheran hymnal in that way if I wanted to. But that is starting out with this.
This is not the result. You start out
as your goal, as a sung confession of the faith, and it is going to. I think that is a healthy way to look at how emotions fit into what we are doing here, as we stand and sing together. We have in this little prayer book. A lot of treasures. I mean, when you think of Paul Gerhardt, this incredible gift to the church in this man and his hymns. And I don't know if you know his hymns very well, but I would recommend you learn them. They're mainly in the Cross and Comfort section, which is a hymn section of the hymnal we don't use very often. But he speaks eloquently of the theology of the cross, which of course is a strong, integral part of our confession. Here again, it's not a popular part because it's opposite of the popular theology of glory, right? And it's often talking about suffering and humiliation and crosses and all that. But look at hymn 428:3. Let's sing the first two stanzas, please. 423. When I suffer pains and losses, Lord, be near, let me hear comfort under crosses. Point me, Father, to the heaven, which your Son for me won when his life was given. Under burdens of cross-bearing, though the weight may be great, yet I'm not despairing. You designed
the cross you gave me. Thus you know all my woe and how best to save me.
Who designed the cross? You see, we learn, don't we? These doctrines are taught to us in this beautiful way here of singing about it. There is that aspect of the theology of the cross, the one that talks about how God refines us and toughens us up, the ones he loves, and that's what we just sang about. And then there's the other part where it says how he chooses to reveal himself to us, his humiliation. Let's sing one of those. And Paul Gerhardt's perfect for that too. 111. He's revealed through humiliation. His glory is shining in this humiliation, right? This is a puzzle to the world, and yet this is very healthy stuff for us to sing about. Let's sing the first two stanzas of this one.
A lamb goes unclear willingly, sin's crushing weight for sinners. He carries guilt's enormity, thy shorn of all his honors. He goes through slaughter weak and faint, is led away with no complaint, his spotless life to offer. He bears the stripes, the wrath of lies, the mockery, and yet replies, willing all this I suffer. This Lamb is Christ, our soul's great friend, the Lamb of God, our Savior, whom God the Father chose to send, our rebel girl to cover. Go down, my son, the Father said, to free my children from their dread of death and condemnation. The wrath and stripes are hard to bear, but in your death they all can share the joy of your salvation.
When you bring your people into that kind of hymn, you've really brought them into something that they are going to treasure for the rest of their life. And it is going to take more effort on your part, but it is worth it. And you've got the time. Just take the time. Consider it an important subject. And something you're all going to work at together as a parish. And we could spend a lot of time just going through, and I'd love to show you the richness of these various great writers for our confession. You know, the Melanchthon hymn on angels, and the Spiratus hymns, and Selnecker, it talks about the end time strife and the times of confession. I mean, this stuff fits us. It truly does. So I would encourage you to get to know your prayer book really well, even if you have to do it on your own, in your own, and then with your family, and then with your parish. I think I'll just open it up to questions at this point. Yes.
Okay.
Well, I don't believe you can separate style and substance any more than you can separate theology and practice. I think they all go together as a statement of what is this substance we are talking about. music is always a servant of the word for us. Okay, that means that it is going to carry whatever that song confession is in an appropriate way for what is being said here. Okay, what is the holy, the sacred, the, you know, it has to really be appropriate in that way. Now, it does not mean that it has to be German, or it has to be 16th century, or any of that stuff. But it does have to be. There is a beautiful hymn that was just written by a pastor out in Middletown, Connecticut, called The Tree of Life. I didn't bring it with me, but it is great. Hymns are still being written in a style very different from what the hymns that Martin Luther wrote, and yet they do. The music there does not lead us into a worldly vocabulary of music, but it is a music that is set apart. It is different. As Athanasius says, our worship should breathe the air of heaven. That's different. You see, that's set. And is that understanding of the holy. I don't know if John Kleinig said that when he was down here with you, but he said every time he comes to the United States, he is struck by the lack of reverence everywhere. I mean, I don't know if he mentioned that, but that is one of the main things that strikes him. Well, I mean, we as in the divine service, this is about the holy, the other. The reverence. The music is going to fit that. And it will either carry that confession well, or it'll lead us off in some other direction. So I think it's important what it is, but I don't think there's any set formula or any set period of music or anything like that. No, I would not be that narrow. Yes. We were just discussing this today. I don't know. That's still, I would have to say, in the beginning stages, it has a long way to go. I don't know if it's going to be able to do the very things that I was just talking about musically or textually. It is going to have to meet all those tests if it is going to be an approved book for use within Missouri Synod. So I think it's a little too early just to tell what will happen with that down the road. But it's really going to have to meet all the same tests. And if it is going to be a hymnal, it has to be approved by a convention. At this point, it is still being called a supplement, and yet everything that they are saying that would be included would make it a hymnal. Now that means it's not only going to have to pass doctrinal review, but it's going to have to pass a convention. So I think that's about all I can say at this point. I really can't get into any more than that. We are encouraged as a commission at this point by President Barry to begin work on a supplement. And he has told us that he would like a new hymnal in the future. It does take a good 10 years. But then it's interesting, as you brought it to kind of a conclusion of what this would then mean, I don't know that we could say that, a hymnal that would unite us, because hymnals seem to do just the opposite. They tear us apart. They are traumatic for the church. I mean, we are still... You see, I am describing here a very stable kind of practice of liturgy and hymnody that we, if we have a lifetime to learn it, then we don't go changing it all the time so that we have to upset that whole rehearsal that... And a hymnal is going to do that for us, and I'm not sure that I can say that it is going to be that hymnal that would unite us. I don't know what the future of hymnals are. It's a puzzling thing at this point. Many are wondering if we will ever have another hymnal. I personally could live with either TLH or LW the rest of my life, you know, and just bring my people up in that and be happy and not always feeling like we've got to be doing some changes. Or even, you know, I know what you're saying. You would like a better one, an even better hymnal, I think, to unite us. And I'm not sure that... See, hymnals are put together by committees, and there are compromises and all kinds of things, and to find that one hymnal that, you know, the Psalter is the only hymnal that really does that.
I don't know, maybe I'm wrong with this assertion, but is it our goal to unite distinctly with evangelicalism?
No, I don't think that's what he's... I don't think that's what he was saying. Yes.
I don't know if you're familiar with Robin Luther's article from Quarterly maybe a year ago, and he linked Luther's use of chant of the Verba to the gospel lesson for that day. And it seems to me that a lot of our congregations are more than willing to have their pastor chant the rest of the ordinary, but the Verba seems to be something that has to be spoken. And if you could comment on that.
Okay. It's a very interesting thing that he brings up, because a lot of parishes will go along with chanting of just about everything until it comes to the words of institution. He has a point there. And I'm not sure I understand why there is that objection. Would anybody else here know why there would be that particular objection? That is, I think, the point. I think it is simply because it is, goes on with this long, the longest chant of the whole.
The learning is the most fun. Absolutely, don't do it until you have to learn. That might be part of it.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Okay. doesn't seem as serious. I think it takes on a whole beauty. Don't we usually sing when we're with feasts and celebrations? And I know what you're saying about taking on this entertainer or performance mentality, and that's why I whenever I work with men on their chanting, I try to take out of their singing and that kind of anything that would, you know, lead people to think, here I am, you know, and here's my great voice. And you make it the words as clear as possible and as simple. Perhaps it would have something to do with how that is rendered, you see. I don't think people complain when it is done very simply in a straight tone and an effortless and yes.
I too have never heard you complain about Catholic chanting. I do recall, however, about a year and a half ago, there was a complaint about the liturgy out involving the choir, in which the choir ended up singing the verba.
Oh well, yeah, that would be. Yes, yes, yes.
Big rallying point for those who want to sort of jump to say, well, it's kind of a difference as long as the long gospel is preached. The divine service itself is not necessarily, you know, one right way over another to do things, or you know, some rally behind that. I know President Barry in his recent article, actually using, you know, through Walter the other way, I just wonder if he had practical pastoral advice.
Well, Article 10 talks about a time of confession, doesn't it? And I believe we're in a time of confession. And when we gather, that's why I think that everything that is a part of the divine service should indeed be true to that confession. I think that that's why the high view of hymnody that I presented here tonight will reinforce that teaching of it, it's what I think in these times we need. We do not need a double standard within the divine service itself, with our hymnody being at a whole different level, or stating something other than, or representing evangelicalism, you know. Yes. Well, I don't think it's a matter of fast or slow. I think it's a matter of singability. I really think that you need to always think in terms of the phrase and the singing line. It's not how fast or how slow. But you need to be able to think. When I teach and work with organists, I always get them singing, and I'm singing around the room, because what they're leading is singing. They're not playing notes, you know. And very often organists just see the notes on the page, and that's what they're translating, and that's what they're about. This kind of technique, or of hands and feet and notes, but that has nothing to do with it. They are about the Lamb goes on complaining forth. How would you want to sing it? You see, and that solves all problems of fast or slow. Once you start to think in terms of singing.
I think you make a good point there when you talk about teaching the organist, you know, to really understand what they're doing there. But get into a parish situation where you don't have a good organist. And that's difficult on a congregation learning hymns and stuff. And if you have somebody that's missing notes and not playing well, then it's a major distraction as far as the liturgy goes. So how do you handle that kind of situation?
That's rough. That is rough. Because the very thing you're trying to hold up may be butchered on a weekly basis. You know, you want to bring the Te Deum in, and yet this organist cannot play the Te Deum for anything. What I would do then, if I would bring the Te Deum in, but I would sing it, and I would lead it with voices. If I don't have an organist who can do it, I'm not going to let the organist bring me down. I'm still going to do the Te Deum, but I'm going to lead it. This is the best leader of singing. It's the human voice. And so I would do that. Then I would try and get some lessons or send them off to some workshops. We have our synodical schools have a lot of summer workshops in just in this hymn playing and understanding their role and stuff. And it's very difficult for you to do this, because then if, as a pastor, you start to talk in a realm that where you're not comfortable. It often doesn't work. You know what I mean? So go and send them off to a workshop and let somebody else tell them about their playing. Really, you. Well, hymn is—it's just poetry if it's not sung. See, that sung has to be in there. I know that's not what you're asking, but I think that this is probably the most basic way. You know, but I don't know if I'd even. You know, if I didn't have any instruments at all, but if I just had one person who had a voice who could model it and lead in it. Or sing it through once or twice for it to model it for us. I think I'd go for it. Or if I had a musical instrument along, a trumpet or a oboe or something.
Maybe to close, I'll ask the last question.
All right.
You know, you hear a lot of people use Martin Luther as the excuse to bring in the music of the world and add a text to that. And I know you've spoken on this before, so maybe you could share that with us. You know, I think you've.
Okay. The fact that many say that Martin Luther went to the tavern for his tunes. Yes. Well, if you really have read Martin Luther on the Divine Service, on Gottesdienst, and on music, and its high role, and I don't know how you could come to that conclusion. You see, it just does not line up. There was one time when he did the hymn From Heaven Above to Earth I Come. He wrote that text. He put that with a tune that would have been sung in a tavern connected with a wreath ceremony, a very innocent kind of thing. He dearly loved that 15 stanza hymn. But then he saw that text had been hurt by the association of this other wreath ceremony that would have been sung in a tavern. And so he sat down and he wrote the tune that we know. Da 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 dum bum. He wrote in the margin that this is the tune that is to be used in all future hymnals with this text. And this is the tune to be used in teaching our children. I find that to be a very strong statement about the associations that even something as innocent as a wreath ceremony, which is not even, you know, a major worldly association, I mean, it just is another association that is going to hinder the confession in that hymn, that he wanted to be clear, that and so no he And then they also say, because they confuse it with bar form, and bar form bar form is simply you know, like, dear Christians, one and all rejoice with exultation springing. And then
there is a
double bar here which sends you back, and the second line has ta-dum, 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 and the music repeated. Okay? That's bar, called bar form. Well, there's a, you know, this connection of the tavern and the bar and Luther and secular music and all of this stuff is, no. And it doesn't line up with anything else you're going to read about Martin Luther. So don't let people tell you that. Martin Luther did understand the importance of the association, or keeping any kind of a foreign association away. And on the tunes that he did use that were already in existence, like the first one we sang, in fact, the God the Father, Bjørnstjerne, it was a contrafacta, and a contrafacta has a secular origin, ending up with a sacred text. But that is not any of the popular, like low popular music of the day. It's more like the art song of the day. And it must have lost its associations at that point so that he could use it. Okay? Thank you. That was real.